University.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these interviews that I'm doing. I have a very special guest today. We're going to be talking about Iran, what's happening, is there going to be a war, and all those, is there going to be a revolution, and all these other great things. Now, before I introduce you, I have to kind of apologize for myself. Despite being half Iranian, my Farsi is the worst. Okay, it is so bad.
No worries.
I've only been to Iran a couple of times in my adult life. I think I was last there in 2003, and my nickname while I was there was Khoraji, right, which means foreigner.
Yeah,
foreigner. My accent is so bad. So you're gonna have to say your own name. I'm not sure how to pronounce
it. Sure. No worries. So my government name, what got doxxed when I made a book, finally I had to come out with it, is Muhammad Ali Mujarradi. So Muhammad Ali is well known. Mujarradi, it's funny, it has a kind of a mystical meaning. It means separated. So a soul that's been separated from the body, but it can also mean single or lonely. So oftentimes in Iran, people say, hey, are you single? Are you an incel? So anyway. My online name that you're probably referring to is Sharzadeh, which means struck by the East. And if you don't mind, I could just explain it for just 20 seconds, because so many people, especially now, are getting this wrong, because I am Anglo admirer or watcher, or I talk about things that made the West great and things that we could adopt maybe to make ourselves great in Iran. And people say, oh, you're so Westernized. What kind of Sharzadeh are you? Sharzadeh means struck by the East, and it's an antonym of people who in Iran, socialists 50, 60 years ago would call Gharzadeh, struck by the West. You're obsessed with being liberal, you're obsessed with being French. So when I was in Iran, I would call my family Gharzadeh, and then they would joke and say, well, you're Sharzadeh. And the subtle implication there that a lot of people are missing these days is Sharzadeh means I am Western kind of in my essence, but that I am interested in the Orient. The Orient has seized me, struck me. It sounds like better in Persian, but it's something like seized or struck or grabbed. So I feel like I am a Westerner in a way, but with a deep appreciation for Iranian, Persian, Ottoman, Near Eastern culture, we can say.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, we may even get into that as a topic, as a kind of way in, because, just before we get going, I'll remind people, pick up courses at the Academic Agency. Trivium is my bestseller there. You also sell courses, right? You're involved.
I do. So we read the kind of Near Eastern poetry canon, mostly in the Persian language, but not entirely. We have all the Sufi greats that people are used to hearing their names, Rumi, Hafiz, Sa'di, Attar. These are the kind of maybe the four most famous mystical poets. And I consider them to be one of the gems that Iranian civilization has given the world. Every civilization contributes something to this human project. And I think that our contribution, aside from the textiles and the very good and subtle food, I know a lot of Westerners find ethnic food not subtle or too spicy. Persian food's very subtle and easy on the palate. It's very much comparable to what Westerners are used to eating. That's good. Textiles are good. The ancient history is good. But everyone has that stuff. You know, you find textiles in Turkey, ancient history in Greek. But this poetic canon has investigated parts of the human condition that I think no other culture has done in quite the same way. And I know you're a man of poetry, so maybe you can you're going to relate to this sensibility.
Yeah, well, I specialize in English literature, so that's kind of
I would say actually Shakespeare is very similar to Iranian poets in a way. I mean, even the Ghazal is often explained as being basically the Persian sonnet, and Shakespeare does also investigate the human condition. And you know, I mean, I have a very cursory understanding of him, but he is similar to Sufi Iranian poets in some ways. And I have courses on those and also just the Persian language as well. So we have courses on the poetry in English and in Persian. And some people say, hey, the English is just not cutting it. I want to read the original. As I'm sure you're conversant in the Western tradition, it's good to know Greek and Latin. Same for us. So we offer Persian language classes for people who really do just want to read the original with me. And we have four or five, I think six classes now a week online. So we're always meeting, we're always reading.
Great. Well, I mean, we're going to be talking about current politics, about Iran and so on. But as a kind of way in, one of my observations is that this idea of being struck by the West, in some ways has been, I guess, a tragedy of Iran's. There's this king, one of the old Qajar kings. He's the one, I forget his name now, but he's the one who had like 30 wives and they all had mustaches.
Okay, so a lot of them had a bunch of wives in the bunch. Okay, I think I know what you're talking about. So he would be the one who ruled, I think, in the late 1880s. Nasiruddin Shah is, I think, the one you're talking about.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
He toured. He like went to Paris and
even came
to Britain. And you can see that he genuinely was struck by the West to the point where he was obsessed with it and wrote journals, and he was kind of starstruck in a way by the modern technology and things. And he was like, I want this for Iran. I want this for Iran.
Absolutely.
And in a way, this actually became the story of Iran in the 20th century. I mean, you can say what you want about Reza Shah, but he spent most of his time in power rapidly and quite brutally stomping on Iranian traditions. In the name of modernization, he was kind of like an Iranian Stalin in some ways.
Oh, that's very apt a comparison. And he, in fact, viewed Hitler kind of as a role model in many ways. They had correspondence in Golestan Palace. You can find a portrait of Hitler with a Nowruz greeting sent to Reza Shah. They were allies. Hitler built our railways in Iran. There's even a folklore about it. There's a neighborhood called basically Nazi land or Naziville in Tehran. Mm-hmm. Now, Nazi and Nazi just happen to sound similar. I think that's the reason. But it's, again, just the lore, because it's close to the railway station that the Germans built. So people would say, look, it's named in the honor of the Nazis. When I was growing up, I would just hear this. And I've been raised in America with this, oh, Nazis thing. And it's just like, oh, awkward.
Yeah, but I mean, when I say brutally modernized, you know, my dad's family is from a group called the Bakhtiaris, who you're familiar with. But they have their kind of own kind of slightly separate history within, you know, the history of Iran. They were always nomadic people. And one of the stories I didn't know is where my own name comes from, right? It was only last year or the year before, my dad explained that my father's father's father, so my great-grandfather, because I was like, where does this name come from? Because the Bakhtiaris didn't have what we would call like first name and surname, right? They had, it would be like, I'm from this group, from this tribe, from this village, from this, okay, and you'd, you know, here's my father and his father before him, and they had this whole spiel they would give where you could almost kind of locate where somebody was on the map. And according to my father, they were in the Reza Shah brought in this rule where you had
absolutely
to give a name and a surname. And my great grandfather was in the naming office in front of the guy. And the kind of officer's daughter was sitting behind him. And he said, well, what's her name then? Oh, Parveen. Oh, that'll do. Write that down. And that ended up, and then because Parveen is a girl's name, my grandfather did not want a girl's name. So he made it. He added the E, Parveen. Yeah. And that's where it came. I was like,
is true, because a lot of people, and I have some friends who are academics who do work on how Iran was modernized, thought that the last name was something stupid. And there was actually a social media post that went viral a few years ago. I think some sort of government document leaked. There's some bank statement with names, and someone just had pointed out some ridiculous names. And a lot of tribal people, like the Bakhtiaris, resisted Reza Shah's coming to power and modernizing, because they correctly understood that modernization would spell the end of their, whatever they knew as life, whatever their life was, it would no longer persist under a modernized regime. So a lot of people also had very random, stupid names because they didn't see the value. They're like, well, I don't interact with the state. This is just some piece of paper they're going to give me. Okay, put the city. That's why we have thousands and thousands of families with just the name of the city they're from. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm from Tehran, put Tehrani. I'm from Maraghe, put Maraghi. That simple.
And I mean, people have to kind of underestimate, or they don't understand even, just how kind of big this drive for modernization was, not just under Reza Shah, But then under the last Shah, I've got this old video people can look up called the Shah's White Revolution, something that almost nobody talks about, where he literally kind of, but like you can imagine this, he banned being a peasant. He got rid of the peasantry. You are not allowed to be a peasant. You have to be a worker in a, like, so literally forcing people who've lived for hundreds of years, maybe even thousands of years, in a certain way, saying, nope, we don't do that anymore. We're going to be like proletariat now in the same same way as the West. And in my view, this is one of the big things that actually led to the 1979 revolution that people don't understand.
Yeah. He sowed the seeds of his own destruction. But what you brought up earlier, I'd like to just give, like, again, in 30 seconds, a 100-year timeline. So in Qajar, Iran, modernization slowly starts to creep in from the Russians. And a lot of early technologies have Russian words or early foods that are foreign. So we have salad olivier, we make chai with an istakhan and a samovar and all these things. And so slowly people for military training would go to Russia and they start to realize, oh, wait, there's a whole world out there. And maybe in Beirut, there's some French schools and they start to learn, the elite kids go there to learn French. And then eventually this kind of advancement of the West starts to become undeniable in the 1800s. So up until the 15, 1600s, we were basically on par with each other, if not ahead. So Europeans would come to Isfahan back when Europe was in what people call the Dark Ages. I know that historians don't like that. But they would be they would marvel at Isfahan had a planned city. It had a square. It was very meticulously planned. They had all kinds of bridges and irrigation, and people weren't just dumping their trash in the street. They were actually living at a very high standard of living. You can read all these travelogues written by Englishmen. And that's kind of where the Persian Orientalists travel, go learn, go buy some clothes started. And you even have miniatures of Europeans coming and adopting Persian clothing because they viewed Iran as a prestige culture. So the high heel, which is now a woman's article, started as a men's shoe. And it was because Persian cavalry would wear it. Or specific types of scarves, like the word shawl, khaki pants, or even the style of pants that we now consider Western pants, were partially influenced by Persian clothing. So we have all this development. I mean, even the whole paisley pattern that you find on ties and clothes, it's a Persian pattern. So Iran was actually ahead. So we were, had this very haughty attitude of, you know, the disbelievers are so far behind. What do we have to learn from them? And then all of a sudden, the printing press arrives with Armenian priests in Isfahan. And the Safavid monarch there says, ah, this is like some Western thing. You're going to print pamphlets and like Christian dogma. Go ahead. Go do your thing. We don't need this anymore. We don't need this from you guys. And then time goes on. And then slowly the Safavids get attacked and they collapse. And the Qajars come. And the Qajars realize we're just getting imposed. This Western diktat is getting imposed because they have this technological superiority. They just roll in with modern equipment and they just say, you will give us this. You will give us your proceeds. We can sell this here. And so he starts to visit, like you said, and he'll go to London and see Hyde Park and think, oh my God, look at this. We don't even have a park. We don't even have a pleasant urban space that's just open to the public for free. And he'll go and see these massive buildings that are hundreds of years old by then, by the way, made of stone and brick and, you know, universities where they're doing the latest cutting edge science. And he says, my God, the tallest building in our capital is my palace. It's three stories. This is unbelievable. So they go back with the right idea that we do need to modernize. But they have this cargo cult mentality with respect to modernization. They just think if you just wear Western clothes and your wife doesn't wear hijab and you are less outwardly Islamicate, that's what they did, right? They shook off the clergy. They missed the internal process, the psychological change, the slow development of a civilization. They totally missed that. But they slowly modernized. And then when Reza Shah came, he's like, this is way too slow. We don't have time for this. We have to go breakneck speed, like you said, Stalin style. So he went breakneck modernization, banned hijab, banned a lot of outward Islamic things, you know, created cities, created institutions, you know, you move fast and break the rules, as they say. And then his son is really the disaster. And he's, well, why the monarchy of Iran, it's famous, you know, 2,500 years ended. And one of his disastrous choices that we never like to reflect on was the White Revolution. Now, first of all, he gave the people the idea of calling something a revolution. He called his movement the White Revolution. In 1978, he went on the TV and said, I've heard your revolution. But what he did was he banned the peasantry. He made them go be proletariat. And he set the seeds for his destruction the same way that Assad was destroyed in Syria, where whenever you have a lot of rural people move to urban areas and they build these shanty towns, there's images I can send you, could overlay it, of shanty towns within view of the Azadi Tower, the famous tower that everyone shows of Tehran. Literally, like, within view, there's just people living in shanty towns directly below it, because so many villagers said, okay, well, we're not peasants, so we'll go work in a factory. And then that laid the seeds of the angry, resentful masses that are shown in movies like Qaisar is one, Caesar, and also another one, The Deers, by Behruz Vusuri. If you guys want to understand the kind of the ahonale, the cries and the wails of the Iranian proletariat in the 60s, you should watch those movies, but especially The Deer. It really shows you, like, the condition of a poor, crammed into tenements, no future, no hope, using drugs. And then those people went out and overthrew the Shah.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I heard from my grandfather, in fact, my grandfather used to, you know, similar to me, he was an intellectual. He used to write books and things like that. One of the things I remember reading in his kind of like semi-memoirs thing was the experience. You know, he actually worked for the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, but the experience of the average Iranian, because one of the things the British did is they brought in an Indian middle management layer, right? So if you can imagine, there was the British boss with his big desk, mm-hmm. and then like the foreman would be Indian. But I don't need to explain to you what Iranians are like. Right. They were just not happy taking right. orders from Indians. And in fact, it was a kind of clever little British strategy. Is that right. Well, if you were unhappy with the foreman, you could go to the fair-minded British chap and he'd be like,
right,
oh,
exactly.
That was a bad idea, Raj, etc. So we kind of helped their authority, but it did lead to this kind of this I think is not well understood because Iran was not formally colonized, right? Mm-hmm. People don't often think about Iran in the colonial lens, but there was definitely a simmering undercurrent where they felt that, you know, things were being run by foreigners. Basically, there was a resentment. All of these things lead into the 1979 revolution. This is one of those things, like, it's an ongoing joke. Oh, look at Iran in the 70s, the girls in the short skirts. But it's like people don't understand this is what led to the revolution in the first place. It was the imposition of something from outside on a people who, for better or for worse, are just proud of their own culture and their own history, didn't like that. They resented the idea that, you know, they were being bossed around in their own home.
Absolutely.
We can now try to fast forward a little bit. There's tons to talk about with the revolution. I mean, one of my views is that one of the issues with the revolution is that it's modeled on the French Revolution. So they're embedded, even in the Islamic Revolution, the kind of architecture of it is French, the intellectual.
Yes, they admit that themselves. Even the constitution was very much lifted from the French and Belgian constitution.
And I was like, well, okay, this is why they're trying to do like French style democracy in a country that's had monarchy for literally 2,500 years.
It's not going to work.
But this can actually bring us all the way to now, because if you listen to the Western media, you know, the government has killed 86,000 people, I think, is the last headline I read. I don't believe that, but I have no way of proving that. It just doesn't sound true, right? 86,000 people, that's like as many
Palestinians
that the Israelis
I think
killed.
There's a specific reason there. They want the death toll to be greater than the Gaza death toll.
It's just not true, is it? Let's face it.
Right, yeah, no. I mean, I believe numbers in the low thousands for sure. I mean, even if someone told me it's 10,000, who are we to know? But it just seems at some point, and actually someone tweeted, they said, by saying it's so high, you're actually making the real number seem small, and they're diminishing the reality of the situation. And I've explained this in one of my videos that, you know, there's this famous quote by Stalin, if one man starves to death, it's a tragedy. If 10 million starve to death, it's a statistic. That we would actually be better off as a diaspora of having the more kind of small, believable number and focusing on the individual sympathetic people who have just needlessly died, rather than this very third world brained, this big number died. No, the number is even bigger. It's even bigger. It's like that doesn't convince any hearts and minds. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So, what I'm trying to transition to is just to get your take really on what's really happening. I've mm-hmm. often joked that if Donald Trump is like the God Emperor of nothing ever happens, then the Ayatollah is like, I don't know, like the Lord High Priest of nothing ever happens.
Yeah. Nothing ever happens, people. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And everybody keeps on saying there's going to be a big war. It's happening this time. It's going to be a revolution.
Right.
And I'm just sitting there thinking, this doesn't feel like it's happening at all. So, I can't quantify that. It's just a feeling I've got. So, what's your take?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think the issue goes back to the same thing I said earlier about the cargo cult mentality vis-a-vis the West. So Iranians thought, oh, if we just build a university, then we will just think like Europeans and produce knowledge like Europeans. But anyone who's studied or taught at Middle Eastern universities understands the same mentality of, education being rote memorization and just reproduction of an existing system persists in our education systems in Iran. Or, a lot of post-colonial nations have this great infrastructure of French or British democracy. But if they're not, Brits or Frenchmen, to what extent will that system even function for them, right? If you have a great system, like if you put me in a room with surgery equipment and I watched 100 surgeries, I still wouldn't want to perform a surgery. So we very much suffer from this same problem where we think that, we could just have another revolution and it'll just work out just because. And, if we just build a democracy, someone said we'll copy the U.S. Constitution. And came to one of my gatherings here, and we gather every week some Iranian diaspora and friends, and we read poetry. He said, well, what if we just copy pasted the American Constitution? And I said, that comment perfectly points the problem in thinking that the Constitution made America, not that the Americans made the Constitution. So what Iranians don't get is that Iran is made by the Iranians. Iran doesn't make the Iranians. So they think because we have this dictatorial theocracy that Iran sucks, and that if we make it a democracy, Iran will be great. What made the theocracy is Iranians, with all of its flaws and some of its successes or projected strengths. So that's the problem, is that we think, if we just run out and yell, and I kind of covered this in my video why it won't succeed, but if we just go out and yell and shout, and then Reza Pahlavi comes, and then we install a U.S. Constitution-based monarchical constitutional republic, whatever, it'll all be good. But it's kind of cartoonish almost. It's hard to take these things seriously. I mean, ultimately, the guns are in the hands of the Ayatollah state and the IRGC, and the American government is not going to put boots on the ground. And without boots on the ground, it's just hard to impose a regime change. We might have already had it, a Tiananmen Square style moment where, a massacre happens, and then shortly after, the leader dies and someone else comes and they really scratch their head and think, guys, we really need to do something different here. We can't just keep going this way. And then maybe everything will be happy ever after. Who knows? But just at the current moment, Trump, he's going to get obliterated in these midterms. Why would he add a Middle Eastern war to that calculation? I mean, it's just unimaginable, unfathomable to think that will happen. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, my view is a bit unusual when it comes to this, because I don't know if you know, I wrote a book, best-selling book now, called It's called The Populist Delusion, which argues basically that democracy is an illusion everywhere and always. Okay, so my view is that the Iranian system, as it is actually as democratic as the British system or the American system.
Very interesting.
Okay, so people, like everybody in Iran knows, that it doesn't really matter who the president is, or if you mm-hmm. get in a reformer or a hardliner, or it could be Ahmadinejad, or it could be dude who's there now. Mm-hmm. The Ayatollah is in charge.
Right.
Yeah, ultimately, it's his system. But I've often joked that, that's the same here, only you replace the Ayatollah with Tony Blair. Right. It doesn't matter who you get in. You're getting Blairism in this country.
Or the deep state, effectively, in America.
Or in America. Right. Everybody thought Trump was different now. But even with Trump, it's clear that, it's called, in elite theory, the iron law of oligarchy. Like by the time you're actually in power, the permanent power structure has already kind of defanged, or it's kind of just for the person to be there, just for them to be allowed into the White House or Downing Street or something, they are rendered safe. And, you know, for the past 10 years, we've been watching all these insurgent populists in Europe, you know, Le Pen or Farage or whatever else, or Trump. You know, by the time they actually get into power, you can already tell they've already succumbed their most kind of radical things. And in exactly the same way in Iran, you know, yeah, you can have some choice. You can have a reformer or a hardliner. But if it's anything that's going to be against the permanent Islamic, the Council of Experts and the Grand Ayatollah, etc., that they're not going to allow anything to mess with that. So I mean, my view is that all this talk of democracy and so on is it's kind of a shell game. It's kind of like
no, you're right. Yeah, democracy. I think a very good way to put it. This is not my thing. Is that what people mean when they see democratic? They mean that they feel dignified, they have money, and that the government feels legitimate is basically what people mean when they say we want Iran to be a democracy. So Gulf states get their legitimacy via old tribal kinship clan structures, and the people are rich and the people feel dignified, so they're happy, right? No Iranian ever said, Dubai is great, I love my life there, I just wish I could vote for the next sheikh instead of some tribal elder council choosing him or successorship. So when Iranians say democracy, they don't even really fully mean, I mean, maybe some very motivated, very well-read academic types really do think about democracy in some reverent way. But most people, what they think is, we're poor, we're tired of this particular ideology being ever-present. We're tired of being the lone person who stands up against the whole global order with, I don't know, maybe North Korea too. We're tired of standing up for Palestine when average Arab Sunnis don't even really like us and we weren't successful anyway. That's basically what people mean. And that's why I've said ultimately that whatever comes next will probably be actually less democratic or more illiberal than what we have now. Because if the Islamic Republic goes, what's more likely to come is a country or a system that drives its legitimacy from some weird cocktail of Aryanism and Persian nationalism and weird secular Iranian identity. The current Islamic Republic is a government where millions of Afghans and Iraqis have moved and settled permanently, gotten citizenship even. I can't imagine a post-Islamic Republic Iran being one where millions of, again, Afghans and Iraqis could get citizenship so easily. Whoever comes next will have to lean into the other angle of our identity, and it'll just be like a fascistic state, but then it won't even have the aura farming that, I don't know, Mussolini or whatever has when you look at the photos from the 40s. It'll be cringe and just badly done. So not even the aura farming, none of the performativeness, just cringe, bad, just weird, mangled state. Like many countries in the world, like you go to many countries, you're like, what is the point of this country's eye? Like Assad, Syria is a very good example. Like you would go there and think, and there's photos of this weird looking guy everywhere, and they say they're socialists, but everyone's dirt poor, and they say they're nationalists, but they're at war with all their Arab neighbors. And like, what is this state even? Like, is it just because of this family this exists? I fear Iran would become a country like that, like somehow even worse than what we have now.
Yeah, I mean, on that front, I just look at the raw power politics of it, and I think, well the IRGC's got all the guns. They own a huge swathe of land over there. They're involved in all. I think my dad has estimated around a third of the country is locked up either directly by IRGC or their cronies. You know, he's given his son something. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, they are basically. If there's going to be a revolution and they're not going to have a massive civil war to turf those guys out, or if the person coming in is not prepared to go full Stalin, these are the people who are going to end up taking over. Yep, and I mean, 100%. when I talked about this with my dad, he says, like, look, they'll just take the turban off, right? Mm-hmm. They'll start dressing, wearing suits, and they'll be like, okay, we'll drop all the religious crap, but we're still in charge. And along these lines that you're talking about, it'll be slightly maybe more of a hunter or something like this.
Yeah,
I can't see any other option.
No, that sounds about right. And I wonder if that situation happened and sanctions were lifted and Iran felt more like a quote unquote normal country, that would just be agreeable. If you look at a country, well, up until recently, now things have changed, but Turkey was something like that, a country where there was some sort of democracy, but in effect, the military is in charge. Or in Egypt, it's just, you know, very transparently a military dictatorship. Even I wonder if Iran was as Egypt is, if you, it would just be agreeable and say, okay, we're secular, we don't have to have this religion stuff. The economy is ostensibly better. Although I've often used Egypt as a counterexample. Often I've told Iranians you could have a secular, pro-Western America ally country that gets funded by America and still be not living well. I mean, Egyptians, I think, are worse off than Iranians, if that can be believed. So there is really no magic answer to this. There's no pill that you take. I remember my dad, he spent his whole time raising me, giving me anecdotes about why Iran failed. He was very, and if you see my tweets and my videos, it's just a continuation of his project, except he was not a public person, but he was always dwelling on and thinking about this issue of our civilization. And not even because he was interested, but because it was so personally meaningful to him and it affected his life so much, right? He left as a 15-year-old to study in America with a scholarship, and then a war happened and all this stuff, and he just couldn't go back. So it causes deep suffering in his life, and you just ponder, why are we like this? Why are we like this? Why can't we just have a country? Look at these Americans. And one of the things he told me was when he was a young child, he also had a scholarship to study English. He came from a poor neighborhood. And one day he told one of his friends, do you want to come and learn English? Maybe you can too get a scholarship. Just stick with me. I'll bring you just this one day. They'll let you. And then the guy left with my dad and returned, and he said, well, Farid, I didn't learn the language. And my dad said, well, you have to go for years. You can't just learn it in a day. This poor, you know, fellow 8-year-old in his neighborhood thought that with 1 hour of English instruction, you could just learn, you could just somehow learn the language. And he said that is an example for how many Iranians, again, this cargo cult mentality, how many Iranians think about things that just like, oh, we could just go out in the streets. People say, everyone go out tonight, just get it over with. They think like one night of everyone being in the street will cause a revolution. Or just if we just switch the government and then we're secular and we have no sanctions, we'll be rich. They'll say, you know, we have oil, we have tourism, we'll be rich. No, it's not. I mean, look at Syria. Syria is not sanctioned. Is Syria rich? I mean, they have a long road ahead to recover. But we think in magical ways. There's this really interesting guy. I can't even remember his name. And I don't agree with his pessimistic take. He's too pessimistic. He was like an Indian guy who was talking about cultural problems in India. And it went viral on right-wing Twitter because it was kind of just like, oh, wow, look, one of them is saying what we think or something to that effect. But he said that Indians engage in magical thinking. And that was a perfect phrase, if I can borrow it from him. Iranians, too, engage in magical. We're jinn-brained, to borrow a Brit's phrase. That guy, Kunle, I can't even say his name. That guy, the UK guy, that guy, he has this phrase, jinn-brained. That is an excellent phrase. Jinn-brained and magical thinking for why we view these situations in a very fantastical way without much sobriety.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've thought about, I mean, I haven't been to Iran since 2003, I think was the last time I was there. But I could tell, certainly among the youth at that time, that despite the Islamic regime being there, and despite all of the sanctions and so on, some element of the West still being the place seeps through into the culture. Like I noticed there was a lot of fast food there, people having burgers, people putting ketchup on their chips, pizza. I mean, it's been... Persianified, but it's still pizza, right? And I'm thinking, you know what I mean? There's still this element where, I mean, whether it's forbidden fruit or whether it's that, you know, the grass is always a bit greener, there was still an element in the youth culture, I thought, 20 odd years ago, where it's like, how much of the Iranian population has this thing, this, because we started talking about, you know, being captured by the West or Western style thinking. How much of that do you think persists within Iran? Because I mean, I was in Isfahan and I was in Tehran, and I thought, well, the teenagers, they're clearly, whether they know it or not, spiritually or otherwise, looking to the trappings of America and the West.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? Despite the fact that they've been told all their lives, this is the great Satan, right? So where does that put... Because one of the narratives that they love to run is that Islam is dying in Iran, that people are atheists now, or, you know, the old religion's coming back, or something like this. This is a kind of... And I've never like that doesn't seem to me to be totally true, but at the same time, there is this other thing that I'm pointing towards. What's your assessment on
where I think there are two really important things to know for everyone listening about your audience, and then this will help you understand everything else. One thing is about what our view of civilization. Iranians are civilizationally aspirational. So thousands of years ago, when the Medes and Mesopotamians were the greatest culture, we aspired to be like them. We use Mesopotamian writing system, Mesopotamian governance style, and all that. And then as time went on, we did our own thing for some centuries, but then Arabs came, and Arabs were the prestige civilization. So we aspire to Arabness. We changed our script. We developed their civilization quite a bit. It wasn't just aping, but also engaging with, and in many ways, especially with the Arabs, propelling their civilization forward. And we had all these interactions with the Greeks, and we were also Hellenized for a period. So we adopted elements of Greek culture. And then when the Central Asians and the nomads came in from the steppe, whether the Mongols, the Turks, or even some Chinese, we became Sinicized and Mongolified and Turkified, which is why our miniatures you see, and you see remnants of this everywhere. We have Greek tile work. I don't know exactly what it's called, the famous tiles that Greeks do, found in Iran. We have hundreds of miniatures, thousands, where Iranians look Chinese. We have all kinds of Greek words, like even our word for honor. It's a Greek notion, nomos. It's a Greek word, nomos or something in ancient Greek, among many other things. Rumi has poetry in Greek. He has tons of Greek words. We would read Greek philosophy. So all this to say, this is nothing new. So it's not surprising that as the Turks or the Greeks or whoever are no longer a prestige society, that when Europe is a prestige society, we look to Europe. So it's not as if we are Indian or we're some other ethnicity where we've just had this kind of inward-looking society or China for thousands of years, and then now suddenly we have this westernization that looks very weird. It's very natural for Iranians to look to whatever the prestige culture is and just copy it without even a sense of resentment, by the way, which is why Iranian immigration looks so different in the West. You have all these integration problems with other groups because they have all this, oh, it's my identity, they're my colonizer, I'll be white. Iranians don't have a problem with just behaving like the prestige culture. So I might find it a bit cringe when Iranians are just throwing themselves at whiteness and just trying, they're aspirationally white. But is it any different than my ancestors who were aspirationally Arab or aspirationally Chinese or aspirationally Greek? No. So it's actually part of a longstanding process. The difference, though, is in scale and in relative power. So in the past, parts of foreign culture would be gracefully adopted into Iranian society, whereas the West, and especially the monoculture, and I really hate it, it's not even really a prestige culture, it's like a global slopified culture, has this monocultural dominance and presence. So it's less of a graceful exchange where, you know, the Greeks take a Persian thing and we take a Greek thing. It's more everything is just totalized and it's not even high culture. It's not like they're walking around with Shakespeare and, you know, Savile Row suits and high tea and all these things. No, it's slob. Like you said, it's pizza and stupid songs and stupid street fashion, you know, roadman fashion or whatever. So there's that, which is a thing that the government tries to confront, but they don't know how to confront it. And this goes to kind of the third world brain, which is, I'll ban it. That's what immediately what a third worlder thinks when they don't like something, ban it. Oh, he represents an ideology I don't like, assassinate him. Oh, we don't like this group of people, expel them. You know, very kind of simple totalizing solutions, whereas we should confront the West and beat them. Like in the Quran, it says, وَجَادَلُوهُمْ بَالَّتِي أَحْسَنَ, and argue with them which what is better. So show Iranians, no, actually, your ancient culture has something better to offer than modern slop Western culture. That aside, the religion element, I would say that Iranians have always had this core of what their spirit is like. The Iranian spirit is kind of enduring. And whatever religion comes, the Iranian spirit shows itself in that religion. So Iranians love the idea of a savior figure. Islam comes with this vague kind of Judeo-Christian notion of a messiah, and Iranians create the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, the awaited savior that the supreme leader is supposedly like the worldly representative of, according to their theology, in some, a little bit simplistic, but in some way. And then now on the secular side, who's their savior? Reza Pahlavi. Is it no wonder? Whenever I speak against them, they say, who's your alternative savior? Literally, like, who is your other savior is what they will tell me. And similarly, if you look at the way we behave, a lot of the way that the protests look, the way the processions are with drums and singing eulogies. It's literally like a Shia procession, except in London in front of the embassy. The way they behave, the way they go around forcing people to put photos of Reza Pahlavi up. I don't know if you've seen this in London. They're going up basically strong-arming Persian businesses to put photos of the Iranian new leader, the opposition leader. The way they do it in Iran, the way they do it with religious things, the way they lash out and abuse people, the secular Iranians like Goldie Ghamri, they literally say, we're going to kill you when we get you. They sound like Muslim extremists. The same way you have the, you know, Anjum Chowdhury's say, we're going to kill you, and we're going to come get you, we're going to kill you. Or where they say, like, we'll demolish 10 Downing Street and build a mosque. They say, we'll demolish the Khomeini's grave and we'll build it. It's the same. Even the way they talk, they showed a video of a guy. He was dressed in fatigues and he was like, we will take you and we will hang you in the streets and we will destroy you and we will kill your children. And someone said, like, the new Ayatollah, the secular Ayatollah. Yeah. So Iranians have this enduring spirit. So basically, even if what we call Islam, the superficial exterior notion of Islam, is not as present because of secularization and whatnot, this will always be there. What Rumi expressed, that deep Persian soul, will always be there. We're, you know, whether you call it Islam or Sufism or Orthodox Christianity, or whether they convert to the slopified versions of Christianity, like, you know, this like American, you know, kind of like strip mall Christianity that Iranians convert to in America, you know, that type of thing. Even when they do that, when they explain what they believe to me, it sounds very Iranian. So,
yeah, fascinating observations. I mean, one of the things I will say is that you're one of the few Iranians who would be as honest to give that description, you know, like just admitting the aspirational part, but just admitting any of that stuff. I mean, there's lots of Iranians who wouldn't, even if they're doing it, they wouldn't admit it. I will say one of the things, I mean, a couple of weeks back, I went to this gathering where I saw some cousins or second cousins or something, quite a large gathering of diaspora who were here, hadn't seen them for years. It's very, I'm antisocial, right? I don't go to stuff. But this time I was directly invited and I was like, okay, can't, you know, I have to say yes, you know, they can meet my daughter and so on and so forth. One of the things I noticed there were quite a lot of people. Let's say there were about 30 people at this gathering. Is that every single Iranian there, where they had two Iranian parents, but they were born and brought up in this country, every single one of them had married a British, whether it's whether it's a girl marrying a boy or it was a male, that their wife would be British. And I thought that was kind of, and obviously my dad, you know, he married a British woman who was, and I was thinking, why is that? There was literally not a single person there had chosen to have an Iranian marriage. Any insight into why that would
be? There's an interesting account that I think it's Aryan Gang or something that posts weird takes on ethnicity and race and origins and whatnot of the Near East. And he posted a really interesting statistic from a paper that showed of Iranian Americans, only 10% of them had married another Iranian, and even that was defined pretty broadly. I think marrying a quarter Iranian even would have counted. And he said it's so dire that they marry more Hispanics than other Iranians, and I think the other 80% or something was white people. There's a few factors. The ones who marry white people, I think there is this idea of, okay, we're going to get along, we're here to assimilate. And in many ways, Iranians do represent the ideal ethnic immigrant for Westerners. I remember I had an Iranian Swedish student told me that he spoke to one of the members of the farthest right Swedish party. I think they're the Swedish Democrats or something. And he said, we will expel all Muslims except the Iranians. They can stay because Iranians go, they don't yell in the street. They don't spit in the street. They don't build mosques. They just, you know, they bring what white people want from us, which is you work hard. You don't cause drama. You bring some tasty food. You bring a little bit of genetic mix up, you know, a little caramel color, and that's fine. No big mosques, no yelling about, you know, colonization, just like live your life. So Iranians, some of it is that. The other one is that Iranians historically are not tribal. We have a high openness to foreigners. We are not like other groups of people where 40% of us marry our first cousins or whatever. Iranians, even in Iran, historically, going back for centuries, have mixed with outsiders openly. And it's because Iranian civilizational identity is based on culture more than it is ethnic origin. So Iranians, you know, have Central Asian origins, have South Asian origins, Arabian, Central Asian, steppe nomad, Aryan hunter-gatherer, Zagros farmer. I mean, you look at our genetic profile, it's a big mix. And this is because Iranians have always had a high degree of openness. So that's part of it. You know, we don't have in our culture, I've never heard of an Iranian being honor killed or being kicked out or being expelled or facing ajira and stress over marrying a non-Iranian. If the parents are religious, they just say, okay, marry a religious person. But I've never heard an Iranian parent saying, oh, my kid has to marry an Iranian. I met one person in my life who said he would like his daughters to marry Iranians so that his grandkids could have Iranian last names. But other than that, I've literally never met a person who even cared in the slightest. And some of it surely has to do with a little bit of self-hate at times, not always. I've met people who say you have to marry a white person because, you know, your kids will be white or something. And some of it also does have to do with just the general cultural dysfunction. So Iranians, we don't cooperate well with each other. It's a very common sentiment for people to say, don't live near Iranians. Don't join or make an Iranian neighborhood or cultural center. Stay away from Iranians. Don't do business with Iranians when you're abroad, meaning, you know, when you travel abroad. They'll trick you, they'll spam, they'll steal your money, they'll scam you. You know, we have a very low cooperation, which is also why we can't build an opposition. We don't have, for as crappy as he was, at least Ahmad Chalabi convinced the West that he could be someone. Whereas after 47 years, we have no institutions, no government in exile, no parties, nothing, right? So that's all of that kind of fits together. And then also Iranians aren't really religious. So there's no religious barrier to entry. But then even the ones that they care, like Muslims, I've seen them marry Pakistani Shias. I've seen Persian Jews marry a lot of Ashkenazi Jews. Iranian Baha'i marry Baha'i convert white people. The Armenians will marry Armenians from other countries. I've never hardly met an Iranian who is like, I must marry another Iranian.
Interesting, yeah. But, and then you just said in passing, Iranians aren't really religious, but... Yeah. You have the Islamic Republic. How does this
exactly
work?
This is Iran, you know, not everything Orientalists say. Some people, and I've spoken, I mean, I kind of got at my start speaking about how Rumi has been treated in the West and in the academia kind of unfairly or incorrectly. So I've talked about Orientalism quite a bit, and my name does mean Occidentalist or something to that effect, or Occidentalist, Orientalist in a way. But it is true that not everything Orientals say is wrong. So a lot of people are just reflexive. Oh, if a white British man from 200 years ago said something about my country, it must be wrong, right? No, not always. One thing that they said that was very true is very cringe. It's been said a million times. Iran is a nation of contradictions. Like every BBC documentary, every Newsline documentary starts with this, Iran, a nation of contradictions. And it is true. You know, we are a people who have a high degree of openness. But then our country effectively doesn't really let anyone come anymore. We have like no immigration. You know, it's just like a very kind of like North Korea in that sense. And we, you know, we have a very high degree of secularism and irreligiosity, but we have the most religious state on earth. So these are just contradictions. Yeah. Who can solve these things?
This will sound like a very weird thing to say, but one of my abiding memories of actually going over there, you know, I was only there for a couple of weeks each time. I mean, being as antisocial as I am, I can't stand more than 2 weeks because after you've met like the 300th cousin, I'm like, oh God, I can't. You know, I remember when, you know, when you know, the lack of respect for privacy. You know, it's six in the morning, somebody sitting down the bottom of my bed, or just like, you know, somebody you've just met sits exactly next to me and puts their hand on my 100%. Leg and stuff like this. I mean, I can't stand it. But one of the things I observed while I was over there. You know, I never drank as much, gambled as much. You know, there were these illegal bottled like cans of vodka, right from Russia, which had nude women on them, like with their breasts out. I remember thinking, like, I'm gambling here, and the money's got pictures of the Ayatollah on it. You know, the original Khomeini. And then, of course, after a certain time, the girls come out and they start dancing and so on. And this is going to sound like such an odd comment, but part of me thought, you know, maybe they need this religion. Maybe there's something about these people. Right? If there isn't this structure to make these people behave, you know, it's going to be too much. So
it's a very true comment. So first of all, you've noticed other Westerners who travel to Iran have said this, that you go in the streets and this is people writing 100, 200, 300 years ago. And they're all in English and very easily accessible. They're in the public domain. You go and you read, and they say, well, you go in the street, it's very austere. You hear the mosque, you see the imam, the women are all wearing chadors. And then you go inside, and they would be hosted by local nobles, right? These Western travelers' curiosities. So you go to the noble's house, and then all of a sudden he has a harem, and there's women, and there's hookah, and there's alcohol, and there's dancing, and, like, you know, slaves come out and perform shows, and you just think, what the hell is going on? I mean, outside, it's so much more austere than Victorian England, but then inside, I mean, they used to even call, I think in Amadeus, they say that there's a play about the Sultan's brothel. It's about his harem, but it's they call it a brothel because they're so kind of just thinking, oh my God, can you believe it? There's this big institution where there's just like hundreds of naked women and there's men everywhere. It's just like a constant party. And the bathhouses of the Muslim world were famous, right? You can see miniatures of a bunch of men just kind of all, I'll leave your imagination. So there's this really weird thing where, you know, on the outside, it looks like a very austere, puritanical society, you know, fit for Salem, Massachusetts, and witch trials. But then you go behind closed doors and it's just, you know, Las Vegas. So what you also said there was very astute, and I've heard this before and other, again, Western academics from hundreds of years ago saying that these people actually do need this strictness. That one, I think English writer said something to the effect of English people are so restrained that the kind of the puritanical notions of Protestantism are not there to restrain them, but they're just a reflection of what English people are like. So a lot of people miss this now. They say, oh my God, there's dry counties in America. You can't buy alcohol there on Sunday. And it's what I say to them is, no, it's not that you can't buy alcohol there on Sunday. It's that the people wouldn't buy it. And then that law reflects their existing norms. And Donald Trump, who, you know, is kind of like a tier two white person, right? He's like a Scot, so he's not like a real English person, really exposed this because he came in and he did so many things where we thought, wait, isn't that not allowed? And turns out, no, actually, it was just that Anglo-Protestant gentlemanliness of, yes, we will show our finances. Yes, we will, you know, abide by, you know, transfers of power peacefully and all that stuff. So similarly, or in contradiction to this, Iranians are the opposite, where we are not self-propelled in terms of our morality. There is this saying in Persian, "Bala sarahar Irani bas chomagh bashe." Above every Iranian's head, there has to be a stick, like ready to whack them down the second they get up. So many English people said that, you know, these people need an austere religion so that they will kind of meet in the middle and be normal. You know, Islam is this austere and they are this debauched, and then we will kind of see each other in the middle somehow because of the austerity of Islam. And you see a lot of secular Iranians, it's kind of very undignified, the lives you see them living in the West. And even they complain. They go on the internet and they complain, oh, I've gambled all my money away. I've lost all my money. I got addicted to drugs. You even see homeless Iranians now in Europe because they leave a society. And this is very well known. Like the Saudi international student is a known trope. If you go to London, you know, these Oxford, Cambridge, the cities where we have Ivy League universities in America, the Saudi international student, the, you know, Khaliji, Iranian, less so the Iranian, but the Arab ones especially because of how their society is a very well-known trope that they come here and they're just kind of like too much, you know? So,
yeah. Just before we wrap up, I need to remember to mention to you, there's, if you're into reading old Orientalists, there's a guy who's known as the, in fact, he was dubbed the steampunk godfather of racism, right? The guy who basically invented European racism is a French author called Arthur de Gobineau, right?
I've heard of him.
Yeah. His famous book is called On the Inequality of Races. Okay. But he was an Orientalist, and one of his great passions was Persian civilization.
Are you kidding me?
In fact, he went to Persia a lot, right? And he, all through this book, he makes these little side comments about Iran and, you know, all the things that we've talked about. It just may be of interest to you. I mean, he does have this notion, he very much leans into this notion of, you know, the Aryan people. And, you know, in his view, Iran has been degraded over time.
Right.
Right through admixtures and various other things. You know, he would see a lot of the things that we've talked about in terms of degeneration, right, if you really understand him, he's not really talking about, when he says blood, what he really means is a kind of spirit.
I understand what you're saying.
Spiritual level. But he's an interesting person because I found that I found this about a lot of the 19th century racists, we call them this. They tend to have like a special side interest in Persia or Iran. I don't know.
They're always Orientalists somehow. They scratch below the surface and they have this deep interest. It's so funny. It says like it's like the meme, every racist group chat, and it's like a Mexican guy, an Asian guy. It's always the racist Orientalist. You scratch the surface and they have this deep, or the racist European of the 20th century, this deep interest and admiration for some random ethnic culture. So some of my most dedicated and interested students slowly have admitted to me that they have like these right wing views, but they're so good at Persian. They read so well, and it's so confusing for the modern liberal person, because their notion is liberalism is openness. It's reading Persian. To be right wing is to be closed off. And I'd be interested to look at that, though. I want to craft two more courses, not just two more, but two courses. One would be interactions between Western travelers and Orientalists in Iran in the early modern era, because it has an interesting lens to just our modern moment as well. And then also notions of Iranian race. So maybe I'll look at his work, De Gobineau, and see what he says about it.
I should mention the flip side of that. The only time I've met like a real life person who's literally just come out and said, I'm a Nazi and show me a swastika, was in Iran.
Nazi.
I was playing chess with him, and he was like, oh, by the way, I'm really into Nazi. And I was like, what?
Have you ever gone through these rabbit holes of where people debate when the Roman Empire exactly ended? Like, you know, what was it? Were the Germans the successor state? Were the Russians ours? Was it Istanbul? And people will say, oh, there was like a town on some island where they actually claimed descent. So the Roman Empire ended in like 1823 off the coast of Greece somewhere. Mm-hmm. You could do a thing where Nazi Germany ended in Iran in the 1960s, because there was a guy who was in the SS who I think was like half German, half Iranian. And then when Berlin fell, he went to Iran and tried to reconstitute Nazism in Iran. And it was called Sumka, S-U-M-K-A. And it was a very big party. And then sometime in the 60s, at the request of America, the Shah exiled him and he died in Sweden of old age. But if you look it up, there was like a big, and even till this day, there's like a Hitler fandom in Iran. There's Mein Kampf books and Hitler portraits, and you just see dudes with like swastika tattoos. And so the Aryanism lore runs deep.
Yeah. Anyway. That's a whole thing. I've never really gone in for that because, again, I'm very much into realism. I just think Hitler needed alliances in the mid-30s.
Right, yeah.
So it was a nice thing to say in the Nuremberg Code, if you're in, you can become a German citizen. But what he was after was an alliance in the Middle East.
Absolutely, yeah. It's ultimately... And Iranians who do this stuff, they tend to not fully understand that Hitler is in the Western canon kind of like a secular devil, and that the West reimagines itself after World War II, and Nazism is like the ultimate evil. What they know is it's some edgy nationalism. It's kind of like in Indonesia and Mongolia and these random Asian countries you find Nazi groups. It's just some weird kind of edgy edgelord LARP. I don't think they really know much about it. And if in their heart of hearts, it's not like, I don't want anyone listening to think, oh, Iranians are all evil. Like, in their heart of hearts, they don't really have much of an ideological commitment to any of this stuff. It's just kind of, you know, third world edgelord teenagers.
All right. Anyway. Well, Barry, so just to answer, is there going to be a war between America and Iran? Is there going to be a revolution in Iran?
Sure, yeah. As a final thing, my notion is that Trump always just wanted a deal. Trump had this idea that he would just dismantle parts of Obama's legacy and then, I don't know if remantle is a word, maybe I can coin it, remantle them in his own image. So he got rid of the trade deals and redid them. And I think he just quit with Obamacare. He's going to destroy Obamacare and then reconstitute it. So his idea for the Iran deal was the same. He tore up the JCPOA, but what he didn't understand was that Iran didn't want a Kim Jong-un moment. That's what he wanted. He wanted to go hang out with the Ayatollah and take photos and whatnot. He didn't understand Iranian pride and honor culture, anti-Americanism. He didn't understand that the nuclear deal barely went through as it was. The Supreme Leader barely kind of tolerated it as a necessity. He didn't understand any of those things, and the Supreme Leader said he's not worthy of communication. So Trump doesn't want a war. He ran against wars. He was one of the first Republicans to blow the lid off the whole, everyone hates the Iraq War, right? Like, we can just drop this. Oh, the Iraq War wasn't that bad. Like, and the stage in 2016 said it sucked and everyone cheered. It's like, whoa, they think that now. So he's anti-war. He just wants a deal. And he's thinking that if he just puts up enough buildup, I mean, he himself said the fleets have to float somewhere. So why don't we just float them towards Iran slowly? And then we'll just build pressure up and either instigate an internal collapse or an internal coup or just make a deal. I cannot imagine Trump will have any type of, unless he inadvertently gets himself into it. Maybe he'll strike and they'll strike back and he'll say, oh my God, I have to strike again. And then we're in a war. In the way he is wont to do things. But I don't think in his heart of hearts he's thinking, you know, my legacy in the twilight years of my life will be a new Iraq war. I just can't imagine that.
What about the Israelis, though, who are...
Well, they want a war, but I wonder how much... I think some people on the right are maybe too worked up about exactly how much leverage or control Israel has over America. I mean, ultimately... Can Israel force Trump to launch a war that will destroy his legacy and destroy the midterms and cost thousands and thousands of American soldiers' lives? I don't think so. I think there's a limit. And there are also, people just think like, you know, there's this puppeteer relationship. I mean, clearly they also understand that it is in their interest for America to also be strong and peaceful and successful so that America can help them and whatnot, this symbiotic relationship. I mean, Israel's been agitating to strike Iran since the Iraq War. And even then, Obama said you can't use Iraqi airspace to strike Iran, so it didn't happen. So they understand. And ultimately, they know Iran is not a threat to them anymore. They've dismantled Hezbollah. Hamas is just like, I don't know what they are, but they're not what they were. And Iran's probably never going to just preemptively strike Israel ever. It just seems impossible to me. I think they're satisfied at the moment. I mean, ultimately, they want the regime gone. But it's not, you know, if you don't do it in a month or in 6 months or in a year. It might be a slow burn, like Saddam's Iraq. You know, they started the sanctions and Iraq lost its kind of control over its airspace in the 90s. And it dragged on. There was a slow grind for 10 years until finally he was so weak that they just went in and flicked him over. So maybe that's the goal with Iran, is just we'll have a slow grind.
My sense is that it's just beyond their capabilities. That's the bottom line. Is that no matter how much they agitate or... And this is why we're seeing these really quite... embarrassing episodes, you know, the attempt at regime change. And, you know, I think the 12-day war ultimately was an embarrassment for Israel as well. These are kind of like desperate last attempts while they've still got some sort of, because, you know, in the long run after Trump, they're never going to have a better chance than now. It would have happened already. That's my view.
I think you're right. And even now it might be a bit of a Hail Mary attempt to try to dislodge the state, because we've covered this. There's no opposition. There is no real strength on the ground that can dislodge these people. America doesn't want a regime change war. Israel barely held out for the 12 days. They were tapping out for the ceasefire. Ultimately, it's a small country, and half of it is not even Israeli or Jewish or whatever. So it's a very, you know, vanishingly small territory that's easy to overwhelm with missiles. Iran has one of the top missile programs in the world. It has all kinds of cutting-edge drones that Europeans are reverse engineering. It's not so simple. We're not dealing with, again, I made this example, I think they wish it was like that. We're not dealing with Saddam in the 90s. I mean, even if people are squeezed, people are poor all over the world. This is something I hate to say. It's sad. I mean, I wish everyone would flourish, but I try to tell Iranians, people can be poor. I mean, look at Cuba. Is Cuba going to collapse? I mean, what other... Cuba is hated by America. It's right next to America. It has a massive diaspora right across the water that wants it to collapse. The people are poorer than Iranians have ever been. And they have no state sponsor anymore. But then somehow it's just still going. You know, states can just... I mentioned this in the video and you responded that states could just kind of drag along. They don't need to be flourishing. I hate to say it, but they could just kind of drag along somehow.
Absolutely right. Well, just before we wrap up, where can people find you?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Charzadeh, also on YouTube with the same name. I've started to make short video essays on YouTube. And my project is all over the place, Instagram, YouTube, website. It's called Persian Poetics, where we have courses on all kinds of stuff. And I do have a book for those who don't want online courses or don't want to see my ramblings on Twitter. It's called The Flame of Love. And we're working on more, or I'm working on more books of Rumi translations. But this is the first so far. It's called The Flame of Love. It's available everywhere and in the beloved United Kingdom as well. So you can get that there. And yeah, thank you for having me.
Great. And I'll just remind people, pick up courses at the Academic Agency, Trivia and the Bestseller. I have a Shakespeare course and many others. and I'll catch you soon, and I'll send you a new link, all right?
Sounds good.
So I'll just...
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.